Good evening. Welcome to the Celery Report. Today is June 13, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. We have a new format tonight. I'm very excited about it, so I hope you are. We're posting our interviews on Thursday afternoon. If we can post the transcript, then we will. It still may take another week. It depends on when we record it or pre-record it. But our interview, of course, is up already on the blog post, so you'll have that Thursday afternoon. And then in the live show, I'm going to do money and markets and, of course, and The Hero and Ask Catherine and Let's Go to the Movies. If I'm doing a whole Celery Report by myself, like the wrap-ups where I'm the interview, then we'll do that whole thing live. But otherwise, expect the live show, other than that, to be 30 minutes. And, of course, John Rappaport will continue to be the pre-record, and he'll be 100% pre-record. Upcoming events, I'm going to be attending the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund fundraiser, sort of benefactor appreciation at Joel Salatin's Polyface Farm in September. More information up on the blog. Then I'm going to be speaking on funding breakthrough energy, crowdfunding, and financial markets at the University of Boulder in Colorado in October. More, again, up on the blog. We'll link to that by tomorrow. And then October 30th, speaking in San Francisco. What's next in San Francisco Bay real estate trends in the global financial markets? Our theme tonight, squeezing the piggy bank. It was inspired by a fantastic Swiss poster, and you can see it up on the blog. It was a poster done for a referendum in which the Swiss, God love them, voted down a new tax, supposedly on the rich. But the idea is all these sort of dark hands coming, you know, to squeeze your pink piggy bank full of your savings. The choice of squeezing the piggy bank as our theme really reflects the fact that what we're watching globally is a war for cash flow and capital. We're at the end of the long-term bull markets and bonds, and we've had years of quantitative easing, both the U.S. central banks, the European central banks, the Japanese central, all the central banks, and what that means is the cost of capital is rising and the game is coming to an end. And what you're really seeing is, more than anything, a war between the overt and the covert, the overt looking for more revenues and saying to the covert, look, we can't keep feeding you this endless amount of money. And the covert saying, well, you know, that's your problem. We're not, you know, we're going to be difficult. And it reminds me, there's a great scene during the New York City fiscal crisis. One of the congressional staffers was pressing Felix Rowetton on union concessions, and he got really exacerbated. And finally he said to her, Eleanor, would you go to bed with me? And she got very upset. And this is in the middle of testimony, congressional testimony. She said, of course not. And he said, well, it's the same problem. They don't want to, and I can't make them. And the funny thing is, if you're the politicians, you're basically caught between squeezing the honest guys who are running around being productive or squeezing the covert. And, you know, and it's dangerous either way you go because it's quite a dance. So, the covert are not sitting down and saying, well, let's reinvent this. So we have the danger, of course, of more and more violence. And the reality is you've just got a lot of players here who are used to getting what they want by pushing harder or with force. And so a lot of the cause of the volatility is we're lurching from stress to stress, crisis to crisis behind the scenes, because that's what, you know, makes it possible for people to get together and say, well, we better start to be reasonable. If you haven't read, there are a couple of articles I've written that I think will help you understand the background on this. One is Coming Clean Beyond the Fiscal Cliff, which goes into some of the reasons why it's so hard to re-engineer the federal budget under these circumstances. A brief blog post I wrote recently, Make Way for the Killers, the Great Tax Haven Roundup, and then, of course, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, will help you understand the challenge of sort of re-engineering the model. The Swiss are being pressured to finalize their tax deal with the U.S. We see the Swiss MPs refusing to approve the deal, and now the upper house trying to approve it without telling the banks or the Swiss people what they're agreeing to. It means the stress is really on. And of course, we've got to get the Swiss under control if we're going to go target all the tax havens, because otherwise the money's going to just bounce back into the Swiss. Money in markets. The swarm on Obama and Holder intensifies. We've talked about this for the last couple of weeks. You know, this week I really said, what is the goal? Is the goal to, you know, to basically push Obama out and put Biden in? You know, that's essentially putting the Vatican's man in charge. And so with the Jesuit at the top of the Vatican and Biden at the top of the White House, you've got quite an interesting combination. Or is it just to tighten the leash and make sure Obama's doing everything that's wanted? The hot spots we're going to talk about are Syria and Iran and bank regulation, but there are a few appointments that are controversial and tied up with that as well. It got so bad this week and so silly that we see, somebody sent me Matt Drudge's Twitter feed, not something I regularly follow, and on 2 days ago, Drudge tweets that the squabbling is so out of control, and then he follows it today with an equivalent of promoting coming clean and spiritual ascension. My words are not his. And, you know, you sort of feel, well, uh-oh, when Drudge hits, that's all you know, it's getting bad. So what happened? We saw the G7 come together in emergency meeting several weeks ago. That's what inspired me to write the blog post on Make Way for the Killers. IRS turned over, but Holder sort of under attack. It slowed down during the week of the Oklahoma tornadoes. And then Bilderbergers gets together and meet. Remarkable job of no tight lids on the leaks and decisions coming out of the Bilderberger meeting. But the swarm and attack on Holder, with many people calling for Holder's resignation, picks up afterwards this week. Next week, we have the G8 summit in the UK with Cameron in charge. The top three issues for discussion include taxes and transparency, which tells me that the tax haven hunt is on, and sort of the nuts and bolts will be discussed increasingly. Of course, transparency means more one in the one-way mirror. That's Glenn Greenwald's term that I love, which means, you know, transparency is they can see everything, but it is a one-way mirror. At the heart of the administration, the U.S. administration's challenge is twofold. One is we have war drums for Syria and the Middle East as the Iranians go to the polls this Friday to reaffirm that they may disagree about the presidential candidate, but not on remaining independent and outside of the empire. And, of course, what is this all about? Both Syria and Iran are considerable leakages on the way to a one-model global empire. At the same time, and not unrelated, rising interest rates and the potential for a real spiral down in the financial markets. In the last 3 weeks, and you'll see some of these charts up on the blog, we see real estate and housing trading off as much as 10%, with several billion in IPOs shelved or in doubt. Municipal bonds, depending on the duration and how you count them, down about 5%. That's even more disturbing, I think, than the real estate and housing, which can bounce around. We see emerging market debt under real pressure, lots of articles, including from the bankers, about the danger of emerging market. What is that really about? It's the possibility of contagion from the Japanese debt market, which James Corbett and I talked about in my interview last week. But the Asian bond market, so under even more pressures. U.S. financials are now starting to trade off, and they have been leading the equity, the U.S. equity markets this year, along with healthcare. So, you know, enormous pressure. We see headlines this week as emerging market debt is sinking, and including the chairman of J.P. Morgan saying real danger in emerging market debts. We see headlines, emerging markets will make up 50% of the world economy. So promoting the growth of Wall Street Journal editorial on volatility. And the problem is that everything other than cash is heading down in this environment. Stocks, bonds, real estate, commodities, both in developed and emerging markets. And frankly, given what's being proposed on the bail-ins, cash does not look as good as it used to. So where do you go? And the reality is that there is no financial solution for a political problem. And all of those, you know, that deflationary spiral reflects a political problem more than a financial one, at least given all the information that we know. And so there's a real need to transform the model, but the reality is that there's no process by which the players can get in the room and start to do that. Certainly, as I said, it looks like the overt guys between G7 and G8 are trying to do it, although G8 means Putin's going to be there, so the stinker is going to be there for the G8 meeting or his representatives. The reality is we're continuing in the slow burn, and that means that the grind for cash and capital is going to keep on going, and that hand is going to keep reaching out for the piggy bank, and it's going to be made worse if interest rates starts to rise. So let's look at interest rates, because there's a very serious story, and I want to connect the dots for you on it. Derivative regulation. We saw the second phase of swap rules go into effect this week. They require financial institutions to bring certain credit default swaps and interest rate swaps into central clearing. If you look at the full gamut of what we know to be the derivatives outstanding, the highest percentage is interest rate swaps. And I believe it's been the interest rate swaps that have been so germane to bringing interest rates down to a phenomenally low level. And that's important because that long-term bull market in bonds depends on those interest rates not turning and rising, and rising particularly rapidly as well. So the interest rates, particularly in the sovereign bond market, are germane to everything that's going on politically. Now, in May, we saw the House, as interest rates were starting to rise, we saw the House pass a bill to try and roll back the Commodity Future Trade Commission's efforts to regulate the banks on derivatives. At that time, we're seeing leaks coming out of the House and the Senate questioning CFTC Chairman Gary Gensler's role in the MF Global resolution. The attack is off point, but of course it's politically more palatable than to say you want to let the banks go free and do whatever they want. So attacking Gensler on the MF Global resolution is sort of politically a safe way to go. Then yesterday, we see rumors from Huffington Post that Gensler is going to be replaced with a Senate staffer who's also a former Goldman Sachs employee, although only there for a brief period at a low level. This morning, we see new reports discounting the Huffington Post leak. What you see is the challenge is that the system and the U.S. government is highly dependent on the banks to manage interest rates down and hold the bond market together. And so how do you turn around and re-regulate them at the same time you're dependent on them to keep the game going? It's a double bind, and the banks and the government are both in it. And what it means is the friction in the system is mind-boggling. And part of the problem, of course, is when you are this dependent on a group of banks to rig things, they always end up taking too big of a skim as payment for doing so. Losing Gensler would be a very big loss. He's the smartest financial person in the administration. He's a principal in his own right. He's an old classmate of mine, so I know him personally. He's one of the few people I know capable of leading this kind of regulatory effort. So it always matters incrementally who's in those positions. So let's hope he stays. It would be, I think, a terrible loss to replace him with somebody who just doesn't have the background or the experience to do the job. If things get critical on interest rates, it could cause a real spiral down. And with someone in that position who doesn't have Gensler's intelligence and clout, again, it could make it worse. One way the system could stop the problem is with more aggressive action on Syria. The reality is cannibalizing another leak in the model and stealing more assets helps to keep the game afloat. You know, we have steadily kept the game afloat with more war, which pushes more cash into the players who are beating the drums and causing the problems. At the same time, we see enormous Sturm und Drang on the NSA whistleblower, and of course there's no new news in the whole story. Wired did a great article on the Utah Center that was up on the blog last year. And, of course, many people, including our blog commentaries, have been following from the Patriot Act on all of the compromises of phone and internet security by the NSA and the intelligence agencies. So there's no new news here. You kind of wonder what the goal of this and who's promoting it and why. The whistleblower story, in my opinion, does not make any sense. John Rappaport had a great blog post asking the questions, and his pre-record for next week is on that topic exactly. So I'll defer to him and I won't go into it, although I did post the blog post and it's a real good one. The reality is, and I also put up a quote from Franklin Sanders, what Franklin Sanders experienced in 1991 and I experienced in 1998 is that the U.S. government was listening to, recording everything we didn't say in a way that, from what we knew, was far outside the law as we knew it. And essentially, they were free to engage in, you know, all sorts of criminality and illegality. And I've documented that. It's all up at the litigation section on the resource section on the Dylan Reed story. And, you know, so I regularly turned in affidavits proving that they were breaking the laws. And it didn't matter. They were above the law. So Franklin put out a quote in his newsletter saying, you know, so now they're doing it to everybody. And I sometimes feel like saying, welcome to my world. So a lot of this is not new news. And so you wonder just exactly why this media circus has been organized at this time. Anyway, the bottom line on this story for you and me is you need to understand that everything you do on the phone and internet is recorded by the NSA and aggregated with the data from other defense contractors. And if you look at the data that they're collecting, you know, from the Department of Labor, from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, there's a HUD document at every closing from, you know, 21 covered agencies. You're talking about database aggregation, which is absolutely phenomenal. You throw into that the healthcare data when that comes, and you'll understand why Franklin and I say never, ever, ever break the law. I have people saying, well, I don't have to pay taxes on the sale of these coins because I bought them with cash. Well, no, you just said that over the phone. So, yes, you do. Anyway, I've written an article about this, which I would seriously urge you to read, called The Data Beast. But it is important to understand that we do live in a world that is essentially going transparent at very high speeds. And we just have to assume that our actions and our communications are not private. There are things we can do to make them more private, but I think you have to assume, worst case, that they're not. S&P raises U.S. credit outlook. That follows Department of Justice bringing litigation against S&P. You know, S&P is the only rating agency to have downgraded them, so you kind of feel like the Department of Justice has gotten S&P back in the corral. Very interesting development this week. A real sign that I think that the accountants are getting ready for crowdfunding. They've posted the U.S. accounting organization has posted up a small business financial reporting framework, and we see Europe come out with the same thing a day or two later. Fannie Mae is challenging the U.S. takeover, if you can imagine that, as the folks at Fannie Mae have always had hubris. Okay, so tonight's interview, wonderful interview with Rainey Reitman, who is the head of activism at the Electronic Freedom Foundation. It was interesting, the NSA story exploded after we'd asked her about a month ago, and so the timing just worked out perfectly. We talk about privacy and what the compromises are and what, most importantly, you can do. As I said, understand the one-way mirror. But if you listen also to Catherine Albrecht, who we've interviewed several times, Catherine's interviews on top of Rainey, they make several recommendations, including the Electronic Freedom Foundation has an app for both Google Chrome and Firefox, and called HTTP Everywhere, and I posted it up on the blog. And you can download it, and it helps protect your searches from being tracked. And then Catherine Albrecht has recommended StartPage, and I put another blog post up recommending that. StartPage is coming out with an email. They're in beta testing, so hopefully that's useful. One of the things I always tell people, I recommend you watch one of the movies that we did in Let's Go to the Movies called The Listening, and it will tell you why sometimes if I want to have a private conversation, I leave my cell phone in the car before heading into the restaurant. Another thing, I always try and encourage you to support the groups that send the lawyers into court. So that's why I'm a big supporter of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, but I'm also a member of the Electronic Freedom Foundation. I was when they first got started, and I've rejoined again. And they're terrific for sending attorneys into the courtroom. And that's important because if you look at the legal battles, it's not just a matter of lobbying Washington, which they do as well. But critical today is to march into the court and battle things out in court, as well as track the international agreements. We've had Scott Tipps on the Salieri Report, who's notorious for following, you know, diving into the Codex meetings and tracking what they're trying to do in the international agreements to remove health freedom. So it's a terrific interview, fun to listen to, and it's inspiring to hear how much a group of people are doing to try and protect the privacy that you and I both would love to enjoy. Our hero tonight is Ang Lee, who is the Taiwanese-born director of our movie of the week, The Life of Pi. And Ang Lee is, if you said to me you could have dinner with anybody you wanted to have dinner with, who would you have dinner with? Ang Lee would be very high on my list. And one of the reasons is I've seen several of his movies, and in fact it's the ones he's won Academy Awards for. He won Academy Award for Best Director for Brokeback Mountain, and then Life of Pi, and he won Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which is one of my favorite all-time films. And what's remarkable is each one of these three films reflects a different culture. One is an American culture, one is a Indian culture, one is a Chinese culture. And each one takes you into such a remarkable, intimate level of a story and a culture and a time and a place. And when you watch it, you think, the person who made this movie, you know, understands China better than any, you know, he's clearly lived his whole life in China, or he's clearly lived his whole life in America, or he's clearly lived his whole life in India. And what's remarkable is here you have this, a person who's not completely of any of these cultures, who understands them in a remarkable way that is so touching and inspiring. One of my quotes, my favorite quotes from Ang Lee is, he says, "I was never a citizen of any particular place. My parents left China to go to Taiwan. We were outsiders there. We moved to the States, outsiders back to China. Now we were outsiders there too, outsiders from America." And so somehow he seems to have developed this ability to look into any culture as if an outsider and see into the very heart of things. And it's a remarkable talent and an absolutely remarkable man. In Ask Catherine, not a lot of questions this week, one coming in from San Diego. Catherine, you said that in your opinion, if the price of gold gets to $2,500 an ounce, that we'll have more war. Can you explain to us why this price would cause more war? I was picking, you know, the choosing $2,500 is simply an estimate. Essentially, the price of gold is a smoke alarm, especially if you have a spiral down in the bond market and the bond market's not holding together and money rushes out fearing instability. It goes into gold, it pushes the price up. And the reality is, if you look at the instability that that kind of situation can cause in the system, those instabilities are not settled with price, they're settled with war. So if you look at the global financial system, now that it is as highly centralized as it is, the system can't brook a radical change in interest rates, a radical change in the gold price, and rather than let the financial system spiral out of control, somebody's going to get hit on the head and his wallet's going to get stolen to replenish the system. You know, so you hear me say some will die so that others may live. But essentially, I don't think the market clears with price. I think the market clears with violence and force. And too fast a run-up in the price of gold or in interest rates is going to lead to war. We see the United States announce coming into the G8 meeting next week that that they have proof that Syria has used chemical weapons on the so-called rebels. We see Zero Hedge saying, you know, the war is on. But to me, that's a build-up coming into the G8 meeting. that they need to keep stopping the link in the model and steal some more assets to keep the game going. So it's not a good sign, but it is what it is. So that's why when people say gold's going to a very high price, unless you have a scenario which is called a radical debasement, where they reset the whole system globally at once, I have a hard time seeing the price of gold go to a very high number. And a radical debasement can only happen after you cut off all the leakage. So you're going to need Iran in the fold, you're going to need North Korea in the fold, you're going to need Russia in the fold, you're going to need Syria in the fold. You know, you've got a lot more leakages to bring into the fold before you can do a radical debasement. But could that scenario happen? Yeah, but in this year, it's a small percentage chance. Okay, let's go to the movies. On Ask Catherine, two quick things I wanted to also mention. Subscribers had recommended two movies for Let's Go to the Movies, which I have watched, but I'm not going to recommend in Let's Go to the Movies, but I wanted to touch on them tonight. The first is Escape Fire. Is a documentary on the U.S. healthcare system. It has a lot of good interviews and a lot of good coverage. The problem is it's a modified hangout. The idea being this is all not working because of some giant accident. It's just a matter of good-hearted people getting together and fixing it. If you've listened to Rappaport's work on healthcare, you know why. You know, that's just not, you know, true. So it is a modified hangout, and in that sense, the ultimate conclusion heads you in completely the wrong direction. The other is a movie series about Stephen Greer's work, and it's also one I don't recommend, although I think there's a lot of good and interesting footage in it. I like Greer's work on Disclosure and Black Budget and Breakthrough Energy. However, the clear communication in the movie that comes through is if aliens exist, they are our friends and we should invite them in. The history of technologically advanced civilizations coming to contact with less technologically advanced civilization is never good for the people who are the less technologically advanced civilization. So if they do exist, the thought of just inviting them in is not particularly attractive to me. So I would be very careful, and I'm quite a skeptic. Anyway, so on to the movie of the week. I've thought all week long about whether or not to talk about the plot of the movie Life of Pi. It's the story of a shipwreck or a young man who is from an Indian family. They have a zoo. They decide to sell the animals in the zoo and move to Canada. And in the process of transporting the family and the zoo or the animals from the zoo to Canada, they're in a shipwreck. And the young son named Pi is stranded on a lifeboat with a Bengal tiger and goes through an adventure, which is quite extraordinary, as you can imagine, and learning to live cooperatively with a tiger in the middle of the ocean. I don't want to give away the story if you haven't seen it, because I really recommend this. I think this is an extraordinary movie. And so let me just talk about why I think it's so important and powerful without giving away the plot. It's really about, and I turn to the author of the book Life of Pi, same title as the movie, Jan Martel, who said, "Life is a story, you can choose your story. A story with God is the better story." And it's really about how do we cope in a world that is brutal, violent, and dangerous? And what is the role of our imagination to help us do so? Is that a good thing? And if it is, how do we tell what's real and what's not real? And these are very important questions to me, because if you look at the circumstances faced by the hero in Life of Pi, it's very much a metaphor for our adaptation to the Matrix. Mr. Global lays down more violence and control, and we invent stories that make it bearable, and we invent philosophies that make it bearable. Even, you know, Mr. Global can depend on the general population to posit it as good and welcome, and certainly the media helps do so as well. But the Life of Pi invites us to appreciate the power of imagination to overcome and outwit the impossible. And it's remarkable how Ang Lee, the director, manages to inspire us to see all the possibilities, because life in the material dimensions can be violent and brutal, but there are other dimensions accessible to us, and we can find power and energy there. And I think we must, if we're going to successfully navigate the material dimension in the state it's in now. So I can't recommend The Life of Pi to you enough. I think it's a marvelous movie and a deeply, profoundly moving movie, and it brings up a lot of very interesting thoughts. Next week, we have John Rappaport pre-recorded, will be posted on the blog Thursday afternoon. The following week, we've gotten tremendous numbers of questions about, should I buy a house now? Should I sell my house now? Should I refinance now? So we'll be doing U.S. housing markets, and I've invited the housing expert at the American Institute for Economic Research, which is an institution I like so much. So we'll be talking about the U.S. housing markets, but from the perspective of what does it mean to you? And if you're looking at buying, selling, or refinancing, we'll be focusing on the issues that will pertain to you, given that there's very different behavior in different markets around the country. And then July 4th, I have the second quarter wrap-up. This is going to be a big one, so if you have issues that you want me to address in the wrap-up, please make sure you send it in or post it on the blog. So until June 27th, when we're back on the U.S. housing markets, please remember, don't worry about whether there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.